Today is September 19th. This is John Gosier, and welcome to AppFreeCast. It's been quite some time since the last show. It's been pretty busy at Africa Labs, so haven't had a whole lot of time to record. But I do want to get back in the swing of things. And first up, I wanted to get this interview out that I've been waiting to put up for a month. I wanted, out of respect of the people launching the app, I just wanted to wait until they announced it. So yesterday they did announce it. The project is called Ujima. And it's a really fascinating project. In full disclosure, Africa Labs was the development team behind the website, but the concept and everything related to the project belonged to the founders, Ron Nixon, Sally Stapleton, and Stephen Miller, who are brilliant journalists who put their heads together to come up with something that attempts to really force transparency in government, NGOs, and governmental aid institutions with a focus on African governments. So as I mentioned before, I had the pleasure of working with their team as they were conceiving the idea for the app and figuring out how they were going to execute. So I had the chance to sit down with one of the members, a guy named Ron Nixon, who's been working at the New York Times for some time now. And I just sat down with him to find out about Ujima in his own words, and just also what it means for the future of journalism and the future of news media. Essentially, Ujima takes public records that are often buried deep within organization websites, and it makes them easily accessible and readily available to anyone who wants to use them. They specialize on the financials related to sending money to African countries, governments, and institutions, and also reverse transparency, seeing where these governments and countries and institutions are in turn spending money. So you really get to see some interesting things that are occurring that you may not have put together without seeing the two data sets side by side. But I'm going to let him explain more about it, and thanks for listening.
So the Ujima project is this idea that comes from doing trainings with journalists and in Africa mainly, where I would teach people how to take information from the U.S., EU, wherever else that had more open access than a lot of the African countries. I think Uganda and South Africa are the only two with open record laws. And Nigeria let Parliament actually pass the bill, but the president never signed it. But the idea is to take that information and provide it to African journalists in a way that's searchable, and it's all in one place, that you don't have to go and look one place for this kind of information, one place for that kind of information, one place for the other, and make it easily searchable, both with just a simple search form or just basically clicking and pointing through links to drill down that information. So hopefully it will provide people with access to stuff that they've never had before, looking at the spendings of their countries around, like, lobbying to influence the U.S. government, which is huge. But also looking at how NGOs operate and their spending in countries, because I was talking to someone in Nigeria once, and he was saying, "Yeah, you guys in the West, whatever the West means, look at this, and you'll go, yeah, Nigeria got like $40 million in aid." And he's saying, "Well, we don't know where that aid goes. I mean, because a lot of it is to NGOs, and we have no idea what they're doing." So this sort of gets at that too, because it takes like the database of USAID vendors. And so you can see, okay, these are all the vendors who are operating in my country, and this is what they're doing. Now this is, again, it's limited because the initial data sets are all US-based. which will give you a pretty good picture because the U.S. is still the largest donor of aid. So it gives you a pretty clear picture, though limited one, but still, it's more than what people had before. So that's the basic idea behind the UGMA project. It's again, we call reverse transparency. If you can't get the information here in Uganda or Rwanda or Nigeria or Ghana, then we provide it from the other side, because one of the, if there is a good thing about aid, a lot of the African countries' budgets come from aid. So with that, there are easy ways to track that from the other side. And so we're hoping that this will be a tool that people will utilize to be able to do that. Not just journalists, but NGOs, but maybe even governments too, because yeah, exactly. And because I was reading this book, I think it just came out, but it was about NGOs in Africa. And one of the things that we're saying, that I know Sierra Leone has hired or has a staff person whose job is to track the NGOs in that country. So I was like, hey, I know how to do that. So that's what this project is about, and I hope that people will find it useful.
You are listening to New York Times reporter Ron Nixon explain his latest project, UGMA. UGMA really represents two things for me. On one side, you have accountability and transparency for government. On the other side, you have this really innovative way of offering journalism to the public, and then in turn allowing the public and institutions to draw from this tool to use it as an asset within their own companies. It's quite brilliant. And that said, my next question for Ron was about the future of news media.
In general, I think that the media industry in the U.S. is in trouble, and I'm certainly not an executive, so I don't know all of the ins and outs of the financial situations, and I certainly don't know all the answers, because if I did, then I would be running one of the companies, and we'd be out of this. But it's not a question of the content. It's more a question of the business model. And that's what seemed to be not really broken, but outmoded. It's just, I don't know if that business model is sustainable anymore.
At the scale,
right. Because, yeah, you could have the New York Times, for instance, my employer, has a website that's one of the most trafficked on the web, but you know, it couldn't support a staff the size of the Times. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer that just changed from, excuse me, a newspaper to a website only. It exists, but it's really sort of like a local Huffington Post almost, unpaid bloggers and those kind of things. And this is not, you know, I have nothing against, I like blogging. I mean, I don't do it myself, but I like blogging. I like to read a lot of the blogs. And I think it's a very valuable medium. And I do think that it does give people a voice and decisions and things like that. But it's not the only way. And neither is, you know, traditional journalism is not the only way. There are many ways of achieving this. But the advantage of traditional journalism is that you have professional staffs whose job is to weed out all of that stuff. And do we always get it right? No. But we do try to get it right. And there are skills and, you know, there's level of ethics. And people do develop expertise in covering things. So, you know, do I want to wait and find someone who has an interest in this to get around to it, or would I just like to see it in my paper or on my Kindle or, you know, my iPod app or whatever from someone whose job is it to do this, you know, and I would prefer the latter. Although the former would be fine once they got around to it. But, you know, if you're a dentist and you blog about, you know, politics, I mean, you could have some wonderful insights when you get around to it. And that's the issue. You know, so I don't want to wait until you get around to it. Once you do, I'll read it. You know, if it's good, I'll read it. So, yeah, it's not an either-or. And I think, you know, mainstream journalism, if there ever was such a term, will survive. It's just, what will it look like? And I guess, what's the business model? And, you know, we're not Google, so the search thing doesn't work for us. You know. And some people are looking at the nonprofit model, but, you know, funders are just as fickle as as advertisers.
Yeah.
So,
well, it raises a whole lot of questions about, you know, who has the power and, like, can they, you know, push certain stories not to get told or to get told, which happens enough as it is. But.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so you do have that issue with saying, you know, this foundation that has its assets tied up in this thing, would they, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily would happen, but it could. I mean, just like an advertiser. So it's not like that model is better than the one that you have now. It's just that people haven't figured out a way to make enough money from this new business model, and people don't know what the new business model is. Some people are saying micropayments. You know, the iTunes model. Well, you know, maybe. We don't know. It hasn't been tried yet. The model of charging. Wall Street Journal charges, but are other newspapers, and Wall Street Journal has a specific thing that it does. But could you do that for, like, my old newspaper, the Roanoke Times? I don't know. Is it unique enough that people would say, hey, you know, I'll pay for that content? It's hard to say. So it's very much in flux, but a lot of the things that we've tried have been successful in that they work, but they just don't generate revenue. So it's hopefully some person who's more brainy than I am will figure out a way to get through all of this.
There's some sort of in San Fran, I think they're in San Fran, that they're taking the idea of investigative journalism and raising, like, a fund.
Right.
And then that fund pays for whatever projects people vote on. I can't remember the name of the company right now.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Which, you know, again, I don't have any problems with that necessarily. That could work. I don't know.
I mean, I don't think it'll save the whole industry.
No, it won't. And then there are people who are saying, well, the Kindle might save the industry. But, I mean, who knows? It's, you know, I both subscribe to the paper, and I have it on my Kindle, and on the Kindle it's about half of what I pay for the paper. How much is that going to, it's not going to sustain a paper like the New York Times. I mean, it's just not going to. So
I think they should open up. Right now you can't set your own prices. It's like, I think they have a cap.
Right.
Do you think they should get rid of that?
You mean Amazon with the Kindle?
Yeah. Or maybe a competitor will come along that won't have that cap.
Right. Possibly. There's some people who are coming out with e-readers that will compete with the Kindle, but again, you know, they're competitors to iTunes too, and iTunes just seems to keep getting bigger. So I think once people are sort of locked in on one thing, it's hard for other people to enter. Like, you know, with the Borders, they have the e-reader. I mean, would the New York Times do something with them? I don't know. I mean, since they've already got the Kindle, it's hard to say. But I, if people are allowed to set their own prices, I don't know if Amazon would want that the same way that, you know, the record companies can't go to iTunes and say, hey, you know, we want to set albums or CDs. It tells you how old I am, saying albums. Want to set our CDs at this price versus that price. No. Yeah.
That's actually good. Reference how Apple did it.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they did.
Right. So they're saying, okay, we'll charge this price and that's it. Now they've upped it a little bit because of the, I'm blanking here, but some of the newer songs that you can not only just play on your iPod, but you can play on other devices. So they upped the prices a bit, but still it's not, you know, it's like $1.99 versus $99. You still get from the older songs for $99. So they have a two-tier thing now. And I think maybe Amazon does seem to have something like that too, because most books are $9.99, but then some are, I was looking at this book on the presidential election for 2008, normal price is like $26, and they cut it in half to like, you know, less, a little bit more than half, like $14. So I think they already have somewhat of a two-tiered price based on the how new the book is. But, you know, can that save newspapers? I don't know. And I guess the other thing, too, the sort of final thing in all of this is when people say newspapers, I think that there's this disconnect, even for people who are more tech-savvy. To me, there's no difference between the paper New York Times, NewYorkTimes.com, New York Times on the Kindle, New York Times app. It's all the New York Times. And so when people say, well, the death of newspapers, well, maybe the paper product will go away.
But the institution
won't. And, you know, I'm not tied to one platform. You know, if it's a dead tree, if it's a piece of plastic, you know, I could care less. And I hear people say, oh, I like the feel in my hand. I, you know, hey, buy, get the paper product. You know, for those people who like it on their smartphones, download the app, but pay for it. And you know, people who want it on their Kindle, fine. You know, I could care less. I think there are people who are more traditional who don't want to see the paper product disappear. But personally, you know, speaking only for myself, I could really care less. I'm not tied to one platform. You know, because I read it on everything. You know, I read it on my phone, I read it on the Kindle, I read it the paper. It doesn't matter to me.
I think that they should, I mean, I generally like free iPhone apps, but there are some that I would pay for. And,
right.
You know, I've never been, like, in journalism, but I do appreciate the industry a lot.
Right.
I have a great respect for it. And I would pay for the New York Times iPhone app.
And I think a lot of people would actually pay for the New York Times.
In fact, I would pay for it if it just allowed me to take the ads out, because the ads are annoying.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, that might be a selling point right there. I should go back and tell somebody that. You know, if we, yeah, I should go back and say that. Yeah, I think a lot of people would. I think right now there's fear that, okay, if we start charging, then people will flock to whatever else is there. But a lot of the content, though, does come from newspapers. I mean, a lot of the content for stuff that's out here where people are saying information wants to be free, well, yes and no. You know, it's expensive to collect and process this information. You know, when I write something, you know, a major piece in the Times, it costs a heck of a lot. I mean, including my salary, travel, you know, well, lodging, food, and all of that stuff. Like, to come here, that costs a lot, you know. And then you can read it online for free, but it costs the paper a lot to do that. Having people in Iraq costs a lot. The information, perhaps it does want to be free, but, you know, it's not free.
You're still listening to Ron Nixon of the New York Times talking about the future of the industry. Next, we sort of talked about sort of the old school versus the new school reporters in the industry, and there's sort of like a loggerheads of people who want the industry to survive as it is, and then the people who recognize that no matter what, things are going to have to adapt. So they're embracing it. And Ron offered some great insight as to one of the reasons why the industry has been so slow to change is how journalists who do embrace new ideas and new technologies are perceived by their peers.
And then lastly, what do you think maybe the future of journalism will look like?
I think the future of journalism will look a lot like it does now. You know, journalism, in terms of getting information, processing it, and putting it into a form that's understandable to masses of people, it's been that way since the beginning, I guess, since the Gutenberg press, or even going further back, with the Chinese scrolls or the Egyptian scrolls. It's taking this thing, studying it, understanding it, and then presenting it to people in a form that it will always be. I think people will have to become more skilled in other categories. Because I remember starting in journalism like 23 years ago, one of the things, I knew like spreadsheets and databases and programming, and it's just stuff I learned on my own. And it's funny that now that's what journalism is becoming, because we were sort of anomalies in the newsroom. Because people were like, well, are you really a journalist? And there was this whole debate on whether or not we were like, the people who had skills like me were really journalists. And so now it's funny.
You
have other skills. Yeah. Yeah, because it's like, I saw this really bad movie that Tim Robbins was in. He's played this, it's about open source, but I forgot the name of the movie. But, he was like, you're either a one or you're a zero. And so for journalism, it's kind of like that. It's like binary, you're either a one or a zero.
Right.
And so if you weren't a one, then you had to be a zero. There's like nothing else in between. But now you see, and it's still like that to a degree, because you have like, if I want information from like FDA, they have stuff in searchable databases on their website. Now, I can FOIA that stuff, Freedom of Information Act, and I can wait for 20 days for them to respond, or I could use Python to scrape the website and use something like Mechanize to trick the thing into thinking that it's like one person just clicking on it really fast and grab all that information. So, am I still a journalist? Yeah. I mean, because I write, and I interview people and I do whatever other journalists do. But so I think more people will, journalism will look a lot like that. Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern has this thing where they're taking programmers and teaching them journalism skills. So I think they should do it the other way, too. They should teach reporters some...
I think that's probably a better way.
Because there are a lot of people who would learn. I worked with a group of 8 reporters at the Times who do that. Develop apps for the newsroom.
I forget what they call them. These guys who are responsible for like the iPhone app.
No, that's different.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's a whole different team. I mean, we had something called a computer assisted reporting team at the Times, and reporters who can do this kind of stuff and can take massive data sets or documents and things like that and make sense out of it and make it available to everybody else, but also take it and generate stories out of it. And then we have a whole section of people who develop the apps and things like that. And then we have another section of people, the interactive news group that does like the DocuViewer and all those things that you see on the web. Yeah. Aaron Pilhoffer, a good friend of mine. We're both from Minneapolis. He heads that. Derek Willis, a good friend of mine, is a developer on it. Brian Hammond. These are people that I've known for years, and we just happen to end up working at the Times at the same time.
API, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So so we have different groups, and then there's like a research group that deals with like the iPhone app. You know, Derek and Aaron, they don't deal with us. There's another group that does. So I think the Time gets it. And that, you know, journalism is not just about putting stuff down. Plus, we have, like, video journalists. And I think that's what the future of journalism is going to look like. You're going to have very well-rounded people who are capable of taking all of the various kinds of information, processing it, and making sense out of it. And then generating really good stories from it, and informing people, because that's the, you know, the basic thing. Because I mean, how many people actually have time to go through something like the Patriot Act? It's like thousands of pages long. You know, legislators don't even read, you know, that stuff. But you know, I can put it in something like FAST, and have it extract and index like every word there and turn it into something like Google on steroids and to be able to go through it, you know, which just throwing something up in a PDF just doesn't cut it, you know. And so that's what I think. And the other thing, too, I think it's going to look a lot more like the people reading on different platforms, the iPhones, the Kindles, the other smartphones, you know, the Blackberries, the what's that, what's the new Sprint thing? The Pre, is that the?
Yeah, the Palm Pre.
Yeah, the Palm Pre. And whatever else is there, too. And then, you know, just maybe home delivery to your home computer.
Right.
You know, instead of walking outside in the morning, you just, boom, right there.
Yeah.
Because that way, also, a large part of the cost for newspapers is the printing and delivery.
Right.
And so, you know, if you can do that, you cut a large part of the cost, you save those costs. You also kill jobs, too, because there are a lot of people who do that, and it's kind of win, kind of win, you know.
Right,
I mean, you win, but then you kind of lose, too. So, but it's like with every disruptive technology, you know, the Pony Express. It was a great thing, you know. But, you know, I kind of like being able to call people, you know. Anyway, that's my two cents.
Thanks.
That was Ron Nixon from the New York Times. I really appreciate his time. We were at a cafe, so I think you heard some people talking in the background, some music. Hey, that's how it is. Thinking about the future of news is scary to a lot of people, but it's really exciting on a lot of levels. Especially when you see a project like Ujima come along that, you know, it's a huge asset. And it's not to say that it hasn't been attempted before, that it's entirely innovative, but it's offering, it's in a space that I personally can't think of anything else that was doing anything similar. I'm really excited about where it'll go. Just the fact that it's taking information that some people may not want you to know, and, you know, just putting a big spotlight on it, you know, that's the very nature of journalism. And it's also really interesting to see a veteran journalist like Ron turning to web technologies to really push things forward when it seems that the industry is fighting it. There's a great article a couple of months ago on ValleyWag. ValleyWag's one of the Gawker blogs, about the Digital Renegades of the New York Times, which is some of Ron's colleagues in a different area. He mentioned some of them. I'll link to the article. But anyway, it just really talked about how, you know, a lot of journalists are now turning to programming because they sort of have to. They have to embrace it. They recognize that this isn't, you know, the way people consume news is only going to go even more so to the web as it becomes more accessible to more people. And this was all about, you know, their thoughts on the future of the industry. And it's a really good read. So I'll link to it, but check it out. So we come to the conclusion of another episode. Please keep tuning into the show. You know, one quick request. Please rate the show on iTunes. Whether you like it, or actually only if you like it, please go to iTunes and, you know, give us some feedback. I know there's a lot of Africa stuff to consume, but I really enjoy the podcast. So just trying to gauge whether... it's got an audience, so help us out, rate the show. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. I'd like to thank Ron Nixon and the Ujima team for working with us at Africa Labs, and also for taking the time to do this interview. So see you next time.